Now, what can I add to that? I do have a list here. My name is Audrey, and I'm a member of the Rock Springs Al-Anon group, and I live in Wyoming. But most of all, I'm a member of the worldwide fellowship called Al-Anon Family Groups, and it's helped save my life and probably save my family's life too. But first of all, I wanted to thank, you know, the people that asked me to come up here, and I won't go into all of the names, but I sure appreciate it, and I love you instantly, whether I met you or not, because somewhere, somehow, you're going to meet a member of my family, and you're going to be able to say to him, come go to Alcoholics Anonymous with me, and you'll save another life. And I truly believe that because he travels all over the United States, but he doesn't go to meetings, he goes to bars again. And that's how grateful I am for you. And I talked to my sponsor about talking. I told her, I don't like to do that. I'm so nervous that I don't even know what I say. I don't have a thing in my head when I get up here, and I have no idea what to say. And she said, just open your mouth and he will fill it. But sometime I think he doesn't want to be up here either, you know, so. we wing it together, I guess. But when I was so nervous about it, why, she said, honey, you know, in one of our books, it says that whether you like to talk or not, you know, we should really go when somebody asks us to go and talk. Because, you know, you may be the only key to somebody's heart. You know, you may say something, it'll just open up that heart. And that's what I believe also for Alcoholics Anonymous. Will have the key to open up the heart of my son. And so I hope today I'll be able to say something that might help you, even though I don't know what I'm going to say. I was born in a little town called Coffeeville, Kansas, and someone reminded me in the back of the room a little bit ago about, that was, you know, a pretty bad place to be, because that's where Jesse James and the Dalton Boys and, you know, all of those people roamed and robbed a bank there and got killed there and all that kind of stuff. But when my dad was a drinking man, and when he was in his worst stages of drinking, that's what the police said to us, was that he's Coffeeville's answer to Jesse James. And I didn't know what they were talking about, because I was young at the time and I didn't know who Jesse James was or the Daltons, you know, because I loved music, classical music, and I loved reading. So I spent most of my time with my head in a book or in the radio or something like that, instead of finding out about all that history. And when my dad was drinking, he would leave home. We never knew when he was coming back. And he'd just show up on the doorstep and course to get well again. And when he was well, he worked. But when he drank, he did not work. And he didn't stay in town, so we couldn't bother him. And I learned to work with my mother, and there was a fellow there that had quite a few homes that he rented out. And so every time Daddy would leave, we'd end up on his doorstep and ask him if we could clean a house for rent, so he could rent one of his houses. And so we would clean houses so we could rent a house to live in, because usually it was just before the rent was paid that Daddy took off. And one time he bought a house And I thought, well, at least this is our home. Nobody can take this away from us. And then he decided to move to Alabama because he had relatives there. Gosh, we were going to go to Alabama. We were so excited. And so we were sitting on our suitcases out in the front yard. And Dad said, now I'm going to go up here and do so-and-so. I forget what it was. And he never came back. And here we sat. The house was sold and everything else. But he decided to go up probably and have a drink and couldn't face it, so he didn't come back. Later on, I found out that one of my uncles, who helped us an awful lot to keep us from really being without food and a place to stay sometime, my dad would tell him, and Dad, I'm the oldest of 11 children, so we had kids coming every year, you know. And well, probably every time Dad came back, I don't know. You know, and I thought you got children from kissing, because every time he would come back, he'd kiss Mom, and next thing I know, she was saying, go to Grandma, take the kids to Grandma, and I'd say, oh, no, Mom, come on, go with us, you know. She'd say, no, you go ahead and take the kids, and every time when I'd come back, there'd be a new baby. And I just thought, well, I'm never going to kiss anybody, you know. Shows you how bright I was. But it got so bad at when I was almost, I guess I was about 13, was in the seventh grade, and I loved school. And a teacher gave me the confidence. I never said a word in school until I got to be about 13, and she told me, she said, you have so much to say on paper, but I need for you to get up and tell it to the class. And I told her, I can't do that. And she said, why don't you try it for me? So I did, and she was so happy. I was so happy. And then when things really got bad and Dad went to jail again and just all kinds of things happened, why, I decided to quit school and go to work. So I quit school and got 2 part-time jobs. And that was, I just thought I was living then for the first time, that I got away from the family, got away from the kids, and was kind of out on my own. I liked that making money, and I worked from 6 in the morning and at one job until 3 till 11 the next, on the next shift, and in 2 different places. And I did that until I was about 18, 19 years old. And when I was about 16, though, I came in the house one day, and Mom and Dad was arguing, and Mom's thing was, is when Dad came back, her mouth started. I had no reason, you know, I didn't know why Mom did that. I'd tell her, now just be quiet. All he wants to do is come home and go to sleep. And her mouth would start. And little did I realize until I went to Al-Anon meetings that my mother was worried about how am I going to feed the kids, you know, and another one on the way, and how am I going to pay the rent, and all of those kinds of things. And I didn't have any idea that she laid awake at night worrying about things like that. But she talked to me an awful lot. We were like friends. But when he'd come to that door and that doorknob would turn, then she would start. And then the fight was on. And then I was in the middle because I didn't want her to get hurt. And Dad, he didn't want to hit me or anything, but I got hit several times because I got in the way. When I was 16, I just told him, kill each other, I don't even care. And I decided I was moving 18 miles away to go to work. I'd still give them half my check. But I didn't want any more of that. I didn't want to live like that anymore. And I knew there was always something better out there, but I could never see it when I was at home. All I saw was things get worse. And my mother was a good woman. She took care of us kids. And I just, you know, I didn't have anything against her except fighting with Dad. And my uncle told me one time that my dad would just say that, well, I'm going to have to go to jail so my kids will have something to eat. And sure enough, when he would go to jail, why, us kids would have something to eat. And I felt embarrassed because those things we had to take from the Salvation Army and things like that. And I was embarrassed about that. And I donated my time when I got older back to the Salvation Army because I did so much for people. But Dad would be in jail, you know. Well, he also had diabetes, and then, you know, as a result of his drinking, diabetes killed him, they said. And he was a young man, and I loved him very much because I was his buddy. We went hunting, we went fishing, we went places like that together where the men went. I could shoot a, you know, clothespin off of the clothesline, and I thought I was a wonderful shot. Now I see how wonderful, you know, other people are shooting little bitty teeny things off of. But, or put me under the hood of a car and I could help you put an engine together, or, you know, find out what was wrong with it. I had three uncles that really loved me and cared about me, and they were my mainstay. They took me to church and all of those kind of things. It gave me a little outlook that there's something to live for out there rather than just what we were going through at home. And it gave me a better outlook, I think, on life than it did the rest of the family, because they're still living in Coffeyville, Kansas today, blaming Mom and Daddy for everything that happened to them. And I did not do that. And I'm so glad when I got into Al-Anon, it really showed me how I blamed my kids more than I blamed my family for the way I was. And I moved to Texas and went to work in Texas with my relatives and had a good time there, got married, had two children, and decided I didn't want to be married anymore, and I moved back to Kansas. Wonderful place to move back to. And started right back where I was. All I saw was people glum and gloomy and everything, and it was everybody else's fault, and felt sorry for themselves, and before you know it, you know, I just, here I was, just existed. I never saw a sunrise or I never saw a sunset in all those years that I was working. Get on that highway and go. I rode with someone else. You know, we carpooled, and I would sleep from the time I got in that car until the time I got back home. And I'll always be grateful to Carl for taking me to Wyoming, because I saw some sunsets just spectacular. Saw some here too. And country that was beautiful, but in Kansas I never saw anything, it seemed like, but just going down the highway and coming back. And that was not a good way to live. It was existing to me. And I wanted more out of life. I wanted to travel, and I wanted to do, you know, a lot of things, and thought, oh, well, you'll never get to do those. You'll be here for the rest of your life. And so my boys were teenagers and just starting to get into some trouble. And I wanted to get away from there because I thought if I got someplace else, then these things wouldn't happen. Blamed it on my brothers and sisters because they would you know, some of them wouldn't help my sons to get in trouble. And anyway, I decided that I would try to go to school at night. So I went to the college at night and got my GED. I'd been sick, and the doctor put me in the hospital, and he said, "You can't go to work anymore." And I said, "But I have to work." And he said, "You can't go to work anymore." And he put me on welfare. Now, I'd heard of welfare before. My mother had too much pride to go there. So that's why we worked, at trying to not get on welfare. But I was on there, and I thought, well, this is the bottom. I've hit the bottom now. And I'm not saying anything bad about welfare, because I know it's there for those who need it, and I needed it at that time, but I couldn't admit it. And this little lady said, "You don't have anything to be ashamed about." I said, "That's what welfare is for, is to help someone who needs it." So I went on and decided that I would, she decided that I, the welfare worker decided that I would go to a vo-tech school. They were giving a basic education program. And she decided that I would go, that I was good material for it. I don't know if she saw more in me than I did, but I'm glad that she did, and also that she was an Al-Anon member at that time, and I didn't know it. But she knew my dad, and my dad hated her, and she did not like him. But anyway, she told me, take this out to the vo-tech school. And I went, took it out there, and I was going to school at night and going to the vo-tech school, plus holding down a small job, too, for the welfare. I was kind of a runner. I took checks to different companies that needed them for the elderly people, and that's where I learned to fall in love with elderly people. I just loved them. Anyway, I went to school there, and that's how I met Carl. He ended up coming out there. The government wanted business people to come and get people to work for them, so he came out there. And he said, "I want her." Well, I know better. I had my back to him. I just looked over there and saw somebody standing there, and I had my back to him. He didn't even know who I was, but it sounds good. Sounded better at that time. So anyway, I went to work for him. I also worked part-time for a K&S oil company and worked for the vo-tech school, too, while I was there, and then went part-time for H&R Block for him. And we were good friends, really good friends. And, well, everybody in that place was good friends. And just the day, I think it was almost 3 years that I worked for him, that we were having a little going away party. Because at the end of April, we didn't have a job anymore, because that's when they quit doing the forms. And I don't know, I said something to him, he said something to me, and there was just something clicked in the eyes, you know. I have been taught all my life, you don't look anybody in the eye, you know, you don't look them in the eyes when you talk to them. He had the hardest time teaching me how to raise my head up and look him in the eye when I talked to him. But when he did, something happened that I'd never felt before. And I asked my mother, I said, I think I feel something for him. Did you feel that way about Daddy? And she said, no. And later on, I thought, how'd she have all those kids if she didn't? But anyway, and then I asked one of my sisters, and she said, no, I didn't feel nothing like that. And I thought something was wrong with me, you know. So I was getting ready to take off and leave Coffeyville and go to one of my cousins in Washington, because I thought, now, I just shouldn't be feeling like this. And then another sister, she was divorced twice, and I asked her, and she said no. And so I really felt like something was wrong with me, but I found out he felt the same way, so we decided to do something about it. So we got married and had a baby and moved to Wyoming all in the same year. And I had those two teenage sons, and when I got to Wyoming, it seemed like everything fell apart. And I told him, let's move away from Wyoming. This is just not, this is not a good place. We're just having all kinds of trouble with my kids. And then he was kind of getting cantankerous too. And, stepdad, I don't know what I would have done. And so we just really, had a hard time trying to make it there for a little bit. Finally, I just thought, well, this is it. We're going to have to move. And the only place I could move was back to Coffeyville, I thought. Didn't know I could move it someplace else. But anyway, we talked things over, and he said, we're just going to have to talk to each other, that's all. Said, you can't solve a problem if you can't talk to each other. And that's the first time I'd ever heard of, if you have a problem, talk to somebody about it. Don't solve it in your head and go on and do it, whether it's right or wrong. And so it helped me, and he said, you're going to have to get into Al-Anon. Well, he didn't have an Al-Anon in Rock Springs. And they just barely had an AA group in Rock Springs when we moved there. So we talked about it, some of the girls and I talked about it. There was three of us. And we were meeting at their meeting on Wednesday night. And this little woman, she was so sweet. We met in their house. And she loved the alcoholics so much, she served, their coffee on china cups. Well, now, the newcomers were coming in there, every time they picked that up, what happened. It rang like a bell because it was her very finest china. And I knew that she really loved them, so, to serve it on that. And Carl said, you're going to have to get that woman out of here, and get in your own meetings. And so when we did that, also, he bought styrofoam cups, put them in the kitchen by the coffee pot, and everybody got their coffee and met there and talked and visited a little bit. So they started having meetings, and we finally got Al-Anon going, and he'd say, I thought he was telling me I was going to have to lecture or talk to them or whatever. I didn't know what Al-Anon was, and I told him, I can't do that. You don't have a hard time talking to you, let alone talking to them. And he said, no, that's not it. You get the literature, you register your group, and then you start having meetings. Well, it was still oblivious to me to what I was supposed to do. So there was a lady from a halfway house that worked at a halfway house, and she came over and she showed us how to register, and we registered the group, got it going. Still yet, I read all the literature that we got, thought I knew everything, because, that's all the literature we got, and I thought that's all there was to know. So I kind of run the group, for a little bit, because after all, I knew it all. And we decided to move out of that house and rent a house, and AA, Alcoholics Anonymous did anyway. And we were all for it. So we had our own room, And then it got worse than ever. They let me chair the meeting. Oh, you're just so wonderful when you chair a meeting, and you do a good job of it, so why don't you do it again, you know? So here, every week, it was the same way. And you know what happened? I sooner or later had to fall flat on my face. And I didn't recognize it until I'd been having so much trouble with my sons. And I went to the meeting that day, and it was on Saturday, and we decided to have two meetings a week. And it was on Saturday, and here was a new gal. And I heard one gal in the parking lot say to her, said, "Why don't you go talk to Audrey?" Said, "She has the same problems that you have." And she said, "Oh, I can't go talk to her. She knows everything, you know." Jeez. And I thought, I'm falling flat on my face, you know, and she thinks I know everything. And I went home that day and started in front of the mirror, and I looked in there and I said, "I hate you, I hate you, I hate you." And I did. And I just looked in there, and all I saw was somebody that I hated. And I said, "And you want your boys to be just like you? Why? Why? You know, what do I have to offer to them?" And anyway, the oldest, I didn't do anything about it right away, but I read the literature a little more and could not give up and give in. And I couldn't even give out. And I had to think, you know, to solve my kids' problems. And the oldest boy, he took his drinking outside the home. We didn't have any problems with him. The only, when he drank, he was a different kid completely. And when he was, there wasn't a sweeter, kinder kid, a hard-working kid when he was sober. And he decided to go to Kansas, so he was completely out of the house. But this middle one, he decided he was going to stay. And then he made up his mind he wasn't going to school, and he wasn't going to work. And so Carl and I had a talk with him and told him that he couldn't. And he said, "I know I can stay in this house, whether you want me to or not. I talked to some agency." He had already talked to him. "And you can't put me out because I'm underage." And Carl said, "I'll show you whether I can put you out or not. You know, you better be out here by this evening unless you decide to work or else go to school." And he went on to work. And I got to thinking about that, you know, and I went downstairs. And my thinking has caused me more problems than... That's why I try not to think anymore. But I went downstairs, and I told him, "You better go find a job, or you better get yourself to school." He said, "I'm not going to do it." And I started to go upstairs, and I turned around, and I thought, he's going to school, or he's going to get out of this house, or he's going to work. And I told him again, and he locked the door. And he shouldn't have done that, because I kicked that door down. And I went in there, and I beat him, and I beat him. You know, here he was, 6 foot whatever. And I was just whacking on him. And he said, "Mother beat me on the butt, you know, don't..." You know, and he got down on his knees, and I said, "What are you doing down there?" And he said, "Well, if you're going to beat me on the butt, you know, quit whipping me on the legs." And, you know, you talk about sick. Here I was in Al-Anon, you know. And anyway, I finally gave out, I think, really, was what happened. And I told him, "Well, you're going to do one or the other." And then I went upstairs. And I had made up my mind going up those stairs. I'm going to get rid, you know, I'm going to get rid of this problem. I'm just, you know, I can't take it anymore. And I'm going to get him out of my misery. And that's what I thought. You know, not one time did I ever think what that kid was going through when he was drinking and drugging and all the stuff he was doing. I didn't think of him, not one time. I just thought he was doing it to get even with me, you know, for marrying Carl, moving to Wyoming, and all of that kind of stuff. Later on, I found out he told me that he was jealous of Carl and that he did want to do some of those things so I would move back to Kansas. I asked him why. I said, you know how miserable we were there, and he said, I know, but he said, I just wanted to move back there. And that was later on, of course. But I went upstairs and I decided I'm going to get rid of that misery. And I don't know, I just must have flipped completely out, because I went to get the gun and I was going to shoot him. And I went upstairs to get the gun. Now, I don't remember calling the police, but the police said that I called them. And I found out later, when I got to thinking about it, I must have called the police on myself, because I knew what I was going to do. Anyway, the policeman came to the door and knocked on the door, and I was so surprised to see him there, you know. And I told him, you better get him out of here, because something's going to happen to him. I'm going to hurt him. And he said, I can't do that. Said, you know, he's underage. You're responsible for him. So he talked to me a little while, and I settled down. When Carl came in, why, you know, we talked about it again. That's all we did, was, you know, we'd talk about it again. And so finally we decided that he was, he couldn't live with us any longer. That's the only way we could do it, because he wasn't going to get out and go to school and work. And he left. And it, boy, I mean, it really tore me up then. I didn't have any idea where he was for, oh, days and days. And one time he'd run off and went to Kansas, and my relatives called me up and told me what a no good mother I was and sister I was, and they gave me cussings and everything else on the phone. I thought, I don't have to listen to this. So I finally just hung up the phone on that one brother, because they had put him back in school and he had been there 2 weeks. And then they called me up and told me, what are you going to do about him? We put him in school and he goes out the back door. You know, so I said, no, the problem's yours now. I said, I've tried that ever since we got here, and it did not work. And I said, the problem's yours, and I will not send to bring him back. That's up to you to get him, you know, get him back. But he can't live with us. And I had told him he can come and visit, but he can't come back. And he lived under the bridge for quite a while. It broke my heart, I'll tell you for sure. And he'd drag himself up that door and you know, be smelling and everything. And he'd say, Mother, can I come in and just take a shower? And oh, I'd almost say, well, you can stay here if you just behave. But we had tried that before. He'd tear up the house and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, I'd tell him, yes, come in and take a shower. And then sometime he'd say, do you have a can of tuna? I haven't had anything to eat, you know. And I tell him, yes, you can have a can of tuna. And so he had fixed the tuna, and then he'd leave. And it was the hardest thing I ever did in my life. And every time he'd get out on the road, I'd think he was dead. And next, you know, somebody had probably killed him alongside the highway or something. And I went to a Al-Anon member's the funeral for her two sons. They were killed on a motorcycle. They were just teenagers too. And it was just like that little priest looked me right in the eye. And he said, you know, death isn't the end. It's just the beginning. And said, Mother, if you're crying over your son like this mother is crying over her son, don't worry. God loves him even more than you do. And said, some way, somehow, you'll make it through. And I thought, God, he was looking right at me, and that's the first night that I went to sleep, and I did not worry about my son being dead along the highway or somebody killing him in the car for a nickel or two, whatever they thought maybe he had. And these things were happening along the highway at that time. But he finally came, in Coffeyville, he finally got into prison. And then he called me up and he said, Mother, they said I can get out of prison. He knew what I thought of him going to prison because he'd been there before, and it broke my heart. But he said, they'll let me come back to Wyoming and live with you if you'll let me. And I said, well, now you know we said you could never come back here and live again. And he said, yes, I know, but they said I can get out. Otherwise, it's going to be 15 to life. And so I told him I'd talk to Carl about it. We'd see. And so Carl and I, again, we talked and we talked. And finally, Carl said to me, I'll do whatever you want to do. If you want him, you know, to come back and try it again, we'll let him try again. And if you don't, why, we won't. And so I mulled that over. I had 2 weeks to mull it over. And on this morning when he was supposed to call, I thought before I got out of bed, well, the easiest way that I could do that is just commit suicide, you know, and I wouldn't even be around here to try to solve this problem. I wouldn't have to solve it. And I thought, you know, different ways I could do it. But I've never believed in it, you know. So I knew God was going to get even with me on the end, other end. So I thought, well, I can't do this. So I just got up, and I was standing washing dishes and looking out the window at nothing, you know, because I'd never seen the sunrise or the sunset. And I was just going at it like mad. And this friend called me up. She was an AA friend. We used to commit suicide, you know, regularly. And neither one of us ever got it done, you know. So she called up that morning and she said, oh, Audrey, I'm just going to commit suicide. And I said, oh, forget it. I said, I tried it this morning and it didn't work. So, So then she got to laughing, you know, and I could always get her to laughing, and when she got to laughing, it was okay. I wasn't worried about her anymore. So we talked a little bit. She hung up, and I knew my son was going to be calling me most any minute. And he called me and told me that, or he hadn't called yet, but about 5 minutes before he called, I looked out that window, and I was mad. And I just said, God, why are you doing this to us? We're trying to live the program and live a new way of life and trying to do what it says, that if you say something, you stick behind it. And we had said that he can't come back to stay, but he can come back for a visit. And I said, now I know in about 5 minutes he's going to, you know, be calling me just to tell me that he can come back and stay with us if we'll let him. And about 5 minutes, I'm going to show you how much I knew. In about 5 minutes, he called me up and he said, Mother, he said, I believe for the first time in my life I'm going to try to help myself. He said, I'm going to a halfway house here in Kansas, and then they'll let me out. And he said, I won't be coming back to Wyoming for a while because I'm going to, it's another town in Kansas, and stay at a treatment center there. And I thought, boy, you know, you think you know so much. And I didn't know a thing because God was working whenever. And I don't know how he could because I wouldn't let go, you know. And anyway, that's what happened to him. And he got 3 years of sobriety. And he called us and wanted us to come when he got married. And he wanted to come and us to come. And when he graduated and everything out of there and got his own place, and it was, you know, it was really wonderful. Now that boy is out there drinking and drugging and trying and doing his own thing, but he has a family, he works, and all that kind of stuff. But there's times when he doesn't work because they also have a business. So he just works when he wants to, but he works all over the United States. And he'll call me once a month and ask me how I'm doing. And I think it's wonderful, you know, because Al-Anon gave me some unconditional love and showed me what it was. It's loving somebody when you don't like what they're doing and you don't have to be responsible for what they're doing. And that sure helped me an awful lot. And we didn't like for him to go back to drinking, because I told him when he called me up to tell me that he was. I told him that you know where it always gets you. And that's where it always got him before. But it's been about 5 years and he hasn't got back there yet. But it's not my problem, it's his. And it took me a long time to find that out. And then Carl and I, one time we got into it, and Carl said something about, why don't you just detach? And we'd just sit down to talk about how things were going with the kids and have a, you know, nice Sunday, talk about it a little bit. And he said, why don't you just detach? And I picked up my cups and I threw them in a sink and busted them all to pieces. And I never did that because my, you know, I like my dishes. But I didn't that time, and I threw them, you know, just busted them all to pieces. And I said, I detach. I'm so damn tired hearing about detach. And by golly, I made up my mind I was going to do it, regardless. And I didn't ask anybody how to do it. I went to the dictionary, and you know it says to cut away. Well, you know I did it wrong at first. But when I finally heard, you know, what the book was saying from people, you know, it's when they share their experience, hope, and strength with you, is when they really get to the heart, you know, because they're giving from the heart. They're telling you a part of them that they don't want to even talk about. And that's the way I got it. Was listening to speakers like you, because we didn't only go to our own groups in Wyoming. We went all over to conferences too, because Carl was going to conferences before he ever met me. And I really enjoyed them because I loved the people. And it's just like, you know, all of you. Maybe some of you I haven't even met, but maybe I'll get to meet you before I leave. And, you know, I love you already, because you're either an alcoholic, not drinking, or drinking, either one. Doesn't matter to me. I still love you because I know there's hope. And I never knew that before. I always thought they'll be like that for the rest of their life. And Al-Anons, you know, who have come and got some hope, there's hope. Because you don't have to live like that for the rest of your life. You just live for today. And, you know, Carl and I have been trying to live together through retiring. Now, I don't know what retirement is, but I thought whenever I was cooking meals, washing and ironing and all this kind of stuff, you know, I thought I was working. I didn't know that I was supposed to be having a good time. But, because that was work. But we decided we were going to retire. So he retires. And I keep doing the same thing I've been doing all along. So, you know, I kind of got a resentment again. And we had a little talk about it. Now, I don't know why I'm doing the same thing I'm doing, but you're sitting in that big chair just having a gay old time watching TV, you know, and playing with your dog. Anyway, I really had to talk to my sponsor about some resentments and some anger and get it out to her, you know, and tell her all about it. And when I was telling, well, I don't know why. I've been in the program, I think, when I had a real problem was 5 years into the program. And what I heard her say was probably not what she said, because she doesn't talk like I do. She's a real sweet person, you know. And I heard her say, Audrey, what makes you think that you're smarter than I am? It took me 18 years to get where you want to get it in 5 years. And so she let me know right away it doesn't matter when you get it, you know, as long as you get it. And so I found out, used the same thing with Carl, that okay, we're going to be retired for the rest of our life, so I don't have to get it overnight, you know. And so we have started kind of working things out together. And I've had an illness that's been plaguing me for quite a few years, and my mother died. And without help for that illness, so she went through an awful lot of pain that she really didn't need to go through had she known there was some help for it. I had this help and had 3 years of pretty good, you know, no pain for that time. Well, it's come back, and that's why I told Carl, I said, you call Milton, you tell him I can't come, because I was in really, really hard pain then. And they got to talking, and he forgot, you know, to tell him. And so Milton called, and I'm telling you, everybody in the country started praying for me. And, you know, I haven't been back in good terms with God for a long time, because I didn't want anything to do with him. After all, he made my sons like they were. He didn't help me, you know, whenever I needed the help. Of course, I got myself into trouble, and then I wanted him to get me out. And that's not the way it works, even though I did a lot of work in the church and all that kind of stuff. But I just could not give my heart to him. And during these times, I've been able to let go and let God one day at a time. And I'd keep saying, even when I was in the hardest pain, I'd say, I only have today, just 24 hours. That's all I've got. That's all Al-Anon gives me. That's all that God gives me. And so I think I can do that. And like 10 days, no pain, you know, because Carl called me one day, and I'd only had one pain that morning, and it was terrific. I'm telling you, it was wonderful. And so I know it's only by the grace of God I'm here today, and I know we'll be heading for the hospital here as soon as we get back. But if it's like it is now, there's not anything they need to do. And I'll just wait, and in God's time, we'll see what needs to be done. And it's only through people like you, you know, that I've watched trudging that happy road to destiny. That's not all fun, but I've watched you do it. And it's through those little AA guys coming into Alcoholics Anonymous that I watch every Saturday night at the open AA meeting. And I love them like they're my own kids. They're coming in there and they're sobering up, and one day at a time. And the older ones too, the same. But that's who I learned from, that no human power could relieve my son's alcoholism, but God could and would if he were sought. I could not do it myself, and I tried it. Tried beating it out of him, run him off, brought him back, didn't beat him. You know, all kinds of things just to get him sober and keep him sober. I did not know where he was getting it, you know. He'd come home, be stone cold sober when he got home from school, and he'd be tipsy whenever he went out. And I didn't know. And when I cleaned the house, well, he was hiding them up above the valances in the downstairs room. And I found all kinds of bottles and needles and, you know, all kinds of stuff down there. And had no idea it was going on, but I'm seeing those same kind of people come in to Alcoholics Anonymous and getting the help they need, and that's saving their lives. And I'll tell you, I'm grateful for that. And like I said, you know, one of these days, maybe my son will walk into your place or someone like him and say that he needs help. And then the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous will be there. And maybe his family will come into Al-Anon and reach out their hand to you. And you'll reach back and they'll have a way to go. I just thank you so much. I know I haven't made too much sense, but I've been nervous, and but I love you enough to know that you'll understand, because once you're standing up here, then you can have fun. Thank you, and I love you all, and thank you for asking me to come. Appreciate it.